The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of The Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, amid the political fallout over the non-appointment of a housing czar, I'll be joined by Mayor of Limerick, John Moran, who's knocking heads together in Munster to get development moving. TV celebrity and author Graham Norton has put his two homes in London and New York up for sale. We'll get a peek inside. Dublin's Doorway Gallery is relocating and are having an art sale to facilitate the move. We'll be chatting to the gallery's owner, and whether it's a puff, a footstool or an ottoman, we'll be finding out the difference with Denise O'Connor from Optimised Design. If you'd like to get involved with our podcast, we love to hear from listeners throughout the week. We're available on email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. I'm on Instagram at SineadRyan100. And of course, you can catch up any of the bits you've missed on the podcast, which is newstalk.com, Newstalk app, or wherever you get your pods from. Now, at the risk of causing it all to come to a shuddering halt, what a fine week it has been weather-wise. We're not used to it, really, and it's so nice to be able to spend time outdoors, even for the odd meal. Are we too hopeful to think it might last through the summer? Anyway, on The Home Show, we are entering the summer season officially, and we will be with you throughout in the garden, at your barbecues, picnics, brightening up your interiors. So if there's any summery topics you would like us to cover over the coming weeks, drop us a line. We'll do our best to accommodate them at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You're very welcome along. Now, there's been a lot of controversy over the appointment or not of a housing czar, with the Minister for Housing prematurely announcing candidate Brendan McDonagh from NAMA, who eventually bowed out of the whole palaver. And amid the political fallout, opposition parties raised objections over why exactly a housing czar was needed at all. Well, here to perhaps explain more about it is the first directly elected mayor in Ireland, John Moran, who campaigned on a housing platform for Limerick. You're very welcome to studio, Mayor Moran.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, listen, you've been in this gig now for nearly a year. Like, the housing thing, generally speaking, we know it takes too long, it costs too much, and there's never enough done. What is your understanding of what a housing czar would do for the country?
Yeah, no, I'm still trying to figure it out in terms of the detail, because it's obviously not being done. But I suppose my reference point for this is in many ways what happened back in the last crisis when I was in the Department of Finance, and we had a banking crisis. And you could say we appointed a banking czar. I mean, I came over from the central bank to become head of banking. But then I realized that in the banking solution, there were two issues. There were a policy issue, and then there was just operational stuff, just making sure that the banks were lending and all that. And what we did was we split the two. Right. And I think that's a model for how we analyse the housing czar. Right. At the time, the operational issues were being handled down in the NTMA. And what we did was we brought the team from the NTMA and put them right in Marion Street in the Department of Finance, on the management team of the Department of Finance, and ultimately reporting to the Secretary General of the Department of Finance, which means they were integrated in the thought processes of the Minister, the Secretary General, central government and everything else. And I think that if I was giving advice to the Minister for Housing tomorrow, I think that's probably a model that could work really well here, right? Where the housing department remains in charge of housing policy and has a housing policy division, and then potentially has a unit that actually drives operational issues around housing and sorting out whether there's a need for getting across, you know, land acquisition or getting funding for housing or dealing with it. But I'm not sure it should be in the Department of Housing. That's actually my problem.
But hold on. We have a minister for housing. It's literally his only job. We have a land development agency. We have various government bodies that are filled with experts, stuffed with people who can get this job done. Is it not the minister's job to knock those heads together?
Well, it is. And that's why I say put whoever is doing this in the department reporting to the SecGen. I mean, bring them into the structures that are already there to support their job. Because the worst thing you can have is somebody gets this job and they're sitting in an empty office and they've got to build their supports. It means they'll lose a year. Mm. Within 3 months back in 2011, by bringing over that team straight into the Department of Finance, they were within the structure. We had done a banking recapitalization by July, right? I think you could do the same here. The other question, though, is whether I mean, there are kind of two different type of departments in Ireland. There's a central department, like the Department of Public Expenditure, Finance, the Taoiseach's department. And then there's what they call line departments, with transport, energy, you know, children's, and indeed housing. And the question is, if you're going to be knocking heads together, you need a minister or a Taoiseach who has the power to knock heads together, to whom you report, and their Secretary General. And so I really do feel that this is something that certainly needs a dotted line directly to the Secretary General of Taoiseachs, but maybe needs to be within that department.
Do you think that Brendan McDonagh was that person?
Well, Brendan would have known the system, right? He would have known how to get around the area. But you can have the best person in the world, and if they're in the wrong structure, they're not going to be able to deliver. And that's really where I think now's an opportunity, perhaps, that everybody's looking at this, analysing it. Now, take a little bit of care about how we set
now,
it up.
While that rolls on, and it will, and somebody will eventually be appointed second best, the problems, to my mind, that still remain, the big blockages, and you've spoken about them, John, are infrastructure, the water, electricity. There are whole housing estates and developments ready to go, but they cannot get off the ground because of what's under the ground, or not under the ground. You know, there was some talk about the Apple money would be used for boring, the unsexy things like water. But, like, it really is essential. So that's one area. And then the other one is clearly the planning system, the planning process. Everything takes so long. And I know there's the new Act is going to come in now, which will kind of circumvent some of that, the nonsense objectors, if you like. Are they the big bugbear areas?
The infrastructure one is absolutely. I mean, we're very upset at the moment down in Limerick. We've been working with a developer. They're ready to submit planning, and we just don't have water for a key town of out in Limerick. And it's not just about the city. It's the same problem is actually rampant right across the country. And Irish Water, Irish Garen, as I guess they're now called, needs some serious investment. I know the government have been talking about putting it in, but they need to just do that.
Mention the water charges.
Don't mention the water charges. But the other thing that for me about housing is there's really three elements to housing, right? There's getting the right numbers, so building to the right demand, having the right policy, and having funding. And at the moment, what I've discovered in Limerick is we're kind of wrong on all three, right? We haven't had the right ambition in terms of the amount of housing we need to do. So we're trying to get that stepped up. We're in conversations. We had the Taoiseach, excuse me, and the ministers down recently. We've explained to them why Limerick needs more housing because it's become so successful in job creation. People want to live there. And we need to change the policy for Limerick because Limerick isn't the same as Malahide or South County Dublin. Rents are a bit lower, but we shouldn't have yellow pack houses when they have, you know, gold-plated houses in areas that are already attractive. We need to have regional cities have a different housing policy, and we're trying to make Limerick the guinea pig, if you want, in respect to that, to try and do things differently. And with the mayor, they should be able to do it. And then we need an awful lot more funding than we've got. And that's been explained again to the Taoiseach. I mean, we literally explained that we need about 16 billion euros worth of construction in housing in Limerick in the next 15 years. The VAT number alone on that is 2 billion. So why wouldn't we be spending 2 billion to activate those sites, put in the pipes and do all the roads and amenities that you need?
As mayor, you've described yourself as a guinea pig in the thing, because of course there's talk about other directly elected mayors possibly in the future. Do you think that it's a powerful enough position that it can alter, or provide a step change in the way these policies are determined? Or is it just you're waiting around to be given the go-ahead to do things?
No, it is powerful enough. I mean, you could be waiting around if you wanted, but that's not my style, and I don't think it's the style of the people of Limerick generally. So what it has provided is a unique access point, you know, our series of access. I mean, we're literally finalising letters to every government department about the NDP. I think we're the only local authority in a way that's been asked to specifically do that. And we're taking the opportunity. I mean, we pushed down at the when all the ministers came and the Taoiseach came to Limerick, we pointed this out, that there is a unique role for the mayor in terms of that kind of access. But I think it's more important than that. It is that because Limerick is the only place in the country that has a directly elected mayor, it allows us to basically say we want to do things differently. We have a different energy down in Limerick. We approach things differently.
Blank sheet. It's you really can draw working. The role.
Yeah, well, it makes it easier for the government to say, well, OK, we'll let the lads in Limerick do it because they have a politically elected you know, leader with a manifesto who says, this is what we want to do. And so I look, the worst that can happen is if it goes wrong, they're going to blame me. And if it goes right, they can take the credit. I mean, you know, but I just care about it getting done and getting seen some action.
A lot of the thing, though, that I have seen you doing down in Limerick, and of course, people know I have an enormous fondness for the place, is small things, John. And I wonder whether there is a kind of something to take from the fact that, you know, if you put out flower planters or, you know, pedestrianise a street or have a firework celebration. It's small little things that allow people to become part of the community. Yes, you have to do the big housing stuff and Shannon development and all that stuff. How have you found in the first year some of the things that you've been able to achieve?
Yeah, no, it's exactly that, right? The first 101 days, because it was just, we counted the number of days, so the 3 months and the extra bit at the beginning, was all about 101 small actions. You know, it was painting bollards, it was cleaning streets, it was making sure that flowers got put in along the Three Bridges Walk. And people noticed the change. And actually what happens is when people notice that change, they look back to their own place and they say, well, we'll fix ours up too. You know, we put out a competition at Christmas for the best shop fronts. You know, we had an amazing display of old toys in one. We had a restaurant actually do up their whole front, and they've kept it that way. And I mean, now I've noticed the lines outside that restaurant, and others will see that too. So you're absolutely right. It's a combination of the small stuff and the big stuff. You know, we're looking at, I mean, you know, we're in the news at the moment about like the fact that we're putting in dog parks. But we're not just putting them in, we're actually consulting with people to see what do they want. Mm. We spent nearly $2 million on playgrounds in the last number of years, and we're doubling up on that and doing more on that, new playgrounds in rural towns across Limerick.
Is it a bit like bringing, like a, not bringing a pride back, but having pride in community?
Yeah, well, look, we all know, what's the first thing you should do when you buy a new house is paint the front door. Right, it's as somebody lives here and they care about the house, and I think we're doing that in Limerick. And look, Riverfest this last weekend was just for me an amazing sort of, you know, celebration of Limerick. My own dinner was all about celebrating Limerick, Limerick food, film in Limerick, and we basically had a designer design some stuff. We did a new art piece that's going to move out into the public realm next. That's really what sort of a lot of Limerick is about. But then the following day on Sunday, we saw thousands of people in the streets using new public spaces in different ways, families coming together, no trouble. The guards were amazing. Our own cleanup team did exactly that, which is they were very conscious of walking the streets and making sure that even though litter was left, that it was cleaned up the following day. So you had a sense of a clean space. And people playing table tennis in the streets. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, people love that idea of maybe buying in then to that community, becomes part of them, and they're prepared, as you say, to do their little bit on their own patch.
Yeah, no,
you
know, my biggest problem is if we do this too successfully, we make our housing demands even higher because more people want to live in it. You'll be moving back yourself.
Indeed. I must ask you about one of the big structures, of course, in Limerick. One of the big stories over recent years, we covered it on the home show, was the building of the International Rugby Experience. Now, that unfortunately didn't pan out. It's gone by the wayside. It's an iconic building. We interviewed the architect of it on the home show a couple of years ago. Any idea what's going to happen to it?
Yeah, look, I mean, we're all sad to see that go. I mean, it was initially, you know, built to be a real statement building in Limerick. And it is, it exists. Actually, around the time of the Team Limerick cleanup, I had a conversation with JP himself. We're kind of saying, look, let's just sit down now that we know where we are. The Ryder Cup is coming. Is there a use for the Ryder Cup? How can we support that from the city perspective? And then how can we find a full-time building? I mean, a lot of it was unfortunate timing for everybody, right? Because it came so close to the beginning of the election and afterwards. Now we're having more conversations with government. There's a new government in place. There's a Ryder Cup. There's a lot of investment going into Limerick, and I think we'll find a solution. I mean, we can't leave a building like that of that quality to sit there. And I know JP's been incredibly generous on so many fronts.
All right. Well, listen, all the best. Continued success. How long is the term? 5 years?
I have another 4 years.
4 years.
The clock is ticking. A year down.
You and Trump. Right. Okay. Well, listen, you've done a lot in your first year, John. And, you can definitely see it in the vibe down there. Anytime I visit, in the people down there, they're kind of just feeling a bit better about their space around them. The housing thing, look, will roll on and continue. And
let's stay in touch on that, because we're going to drive out some new ideas, I hope.
Good. All right. Well, we will stay in touch with that. And thanks for joining us and taking us the time on the home show today.
Thanks, mate.
Now, talk show host turned author and winemaker Graham Norton has just put his palatial New York and London properties up for sale. He purchased the US home from supermodel Claudia Schiffer, and previous owners included Cole Porter and Lenny Kravitz. Well, joining me now to take a peek inside and investigate it a little bit more is Alana Gallagher from the Irish Times. Alana, you're very welcome along to the home show. You've been writing about these fabulous homes that Graham Norton is now selling. Do we know why he's put them on the market?
No, we don't. But I mean, these are properties he bought in the early noughties, you know. So he bought the beautiful one in the Tan House in New York in 2002, and he then he bought his London home in the following year, 2003. So you could speculate that, look, you know, a lot of financial advisors would sort of discuss 20-year plans more or less with their clients, and maybe it's time to move the properties on. You could also look at the markets and sort of say, you know, maybe they have topped out slightly at the super prime level that he's selling at. But, you know, I suppose what's really galvanizing interest in these is actually the houses themselves and Graham Norton as an entity and a celebrity. You know, he has these beautiful homes and nobody is bad-mouthing him on having all this good fortune in a way. Beautiful Mews House in an enclave of 10. I mean, it's a historic building in America, rare enough. It goes back to the Civil War when they were stables and is on a historic register. And as you say, the provenance of it, like to buy it from a supermodel like Claudia Schiffer, I mean, that in itself is a great dinner party story.
Now, it is unusual, of course, to have a townhouse like this anywhere, really, in New York, especially Murray Hill. It's very upscale. It's absolutely beautiful. It's on Manhattan's east side. He's asking for $5.5 million for it. Tell us a little bit about the size of it, because I mean it's not huge. It's a three-story, two-bed, two-bath.
And you walk straight into what they call the great room, which we would just call a drawing room or a living room, really. So like there's no porch, there's no grand entrance, you know, scene-setting kind of entrance. It's 232 square meters over three stories, which is 2,500 square feet, as they say in America generally. But look, it has a rooftop terrace. You know, you've got the Chrysler Building, you've got the Empire State in your sight lines from up there. You have entertaining aplenty. And, you know, if you're dealing with previous owners of that caliber, it is incredibly luxurious. It's gated, which for Manhattan would also be relatively rare. So it's very private for that part of the city. And, you know, there would be a lot of a demand. I mean, as the previous owner would attest to, and equally the neighbours, you know, you're in very good company. And estate agents in the States, you know, and here would have a list in that super prime market. As with any sort of buyers, they kind of know who's going to be purchasing this. They'd have lists. They'd have people come to them saying, I'm looking for this. There are people who actually have the money and we'll say, look, if house ever comes up on X Street, let me know, I'm interested.
And of course, estate agents here do the same thing, so it's possible.
Exactly the same thing here, at that level of the market, yeah. I mean, it's incredibly private generally, and that's what's kind of interesting here. This is so public, it's on every single interior site, it's all over Insta. We've done incredibly well with it. Our audience is really engaged with it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you take Graham Norton, he's an incredibly down-to-earth man. Mm. You know, it's a far cry from the caravan when he was playing Father Ted Furlong in Father Ted in the sort of mid-90s. I mean, 30 years of success as a host, as a talk show host. I mean, it is an incredible run. He's a novelist and non-fiction writer as well. And, you know, has six different wines to his name.
Yes, and I've tasted all of them. They're all absolutely delicious. And I presume there is, you know, room for a wine fridge in all of these houses. Talk to me, Alana, about the London home now. So this is on Wapping High Street. It's a former customs office, I believe.
Now, this is grade two listed property, beautiful red brick exterior, Georgian townhouse on the banks of the Thames. In and of itself, incredibly rare. And there's a shared garden. There's a beach where you can, you know, go down to at low tide, so twice a day. There are manicured gardens, and it is also joined to a warehouse to the back. So So you get this kind of New York loft feel in the back of the house, and yet you have these beautiful period rooms with gorgeous kind of square proportions of that era, beautiful window boxes, high ceilings, and very tastefully low-key decorated. What it kind of struck me about it is, you know, how fashions ebb and flow, and, you know, the sort of stripped pine window boxes and timber staircases would have been very big in the 80s and early 90s, and to see them back in, mm-hmm. in a classic contemporary environment is really interesting from somebody like himself, because he's quite a, you know, a flamboyant dresser. He's not afraid to mince his words, you know, he's pithy. Well, and I really like the idea that there's books on show as well. You know, in a lot of celebrity homes, they're almost like, you know, part of their own, an extension of their own curation in a way. And they're often afraid to personalize in any way. What I loved to see was the idea that these were bookshelves and they weren't bought by the yard, you know, as props.
Yeah, staged books make me look intelligent. Come here, Lana, there's a big difference in the interior aesthetic between the New York, the Murray Hill property and the London one. The Murray Hill one has been described as a jewel box with these bright, vibrant kind of greens and reds and yellows, whereas the London home is much more understated.
Yeah. Now, I don't know who designed. I'm going to guess that there was somebody involved in the London home also, just because he's so busy, even just to manage his own ideas. But Gasho Studios did the New York premises, and it is very stylized, and it photographs really well. It's rich jewel colors, which work with the size of the property. The London property is a very different kind of lady, really. She's a much more she's much more aristocratic in a way, despite all the provenance of the New York one. She's a bigger property, you know. She's like 343 square meters, 3,700 square feet, over four floors. It's a much, much bigger property, more classic and more London. Do you know what I mean? I think they both evoke the cities that they have been constructed in. But I do think it's very interesting, again, for such a modern man that he's gone for these period piles in a way.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Now, of course, Graham Norton is not going to be rendered homeless in the sale of these properties. He also famously has a property in West Cork, and he got married there in 2022. It's 4,000 square feet. I had kissed a house. He's holding on to that, Alana, or is there any danger that'll go on the market too?
Well, I think the whole of West Cork would be up in arms campaigning to the local TDs if he did. The word from, you know, estate agents in the know in that part of the world is that no, they're not, and that they would be very surprised if he is. He's very well regarded and so well involved in the local community. They love him, you know, and he's a great asset there. He's, I mean, he shouted out a neighbour's property on Twitter years ago that when it came up for sale, really greatly enhancing the number of eyeballs on it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to do that kind of thing. And I think, you know, I think it's lovely that he's gotten married, and maybe he just has realized, you know, I have achieved all this. What's it all for? Maybe him and
Jono MacLeod, yeah, his husband.
The sunset.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I hope he's not sailing off our screens or out of the vineyards anytime soon, because as you say, he is such a wide-ranging individual in all that he does. Alana, you were saying that, you know, you got a lot of attention for this piece, which of course people can read in the Irish Times about these properties. Do celebrity homes generally get more attention than others just because of the owner?
Well, they do and they don't. I mean, what a good story. I think it comes back to that in everything. It is a good story and the storytelling. You know, I mean, we've had houses that are owned by, you know, people who fly very under the radar, but actually have just done something really interesting with their homes and express their personality in the same way that people dress fashionably or somewhat theatrically to indeed do the same thing, and that is express their personality. And we live in a very visual world, you know. People are, you know, documenting their home renovations on various social platforms. They're not necessarily doing it, you know, for anything more than their own amusement as well, you know. And sharing of information. There's an awful lot of information you can get. People are very generous with it, generally, I find. And, you know, There's a lot of the same kind of stuff there. So people are always looking for something that will make your own home stand out or move on. Yeah. Because if you do keep your nose in on social feeds too much, you know, trends come and go by the time you're finished scrolling. And, you know, you're going to be left living with something. So you do need to really think about how you want to decorate a home and make sure that it works for you. It doesn't really matter whether it's on trend or not.
Exactly. And of course, at that,
you and your personality.
At those price points, you can expect the next celebrity who buys it will probably do it over one way or the other. All right. Alana Gallagher from the Irish Times, thanks a million for bringing us up to date on all of Graham Norton's properties. Now, art lovers and collectors are being offered a rare opportunity to purchase original works at a hugely discounted price in advance of the Doorway Gallery's relocation at the end of May. Joining me now with news of the fantastic sale to facilitate the move is the gallery's owner, Denise Donnelly. Denise, you're very welcome back to the Home Show studio. We've been having a bit of a laugh there in the
Thank
break.
Thank you for having me.
But we're going to get serious now and talk to me. Why are you moving?
So the building we've been in on South Frederick Street for 15 years, close to 15 years, and they unfortunately are building a hotel there.
Oh, another hotel.
I know. So we kind of knew we were moving for a while because we were on a month-to-month lease for the last 3 years. But obviously when you get the news, it's still kind of devastating that we have to go. But at least the new building that we're moving to is secure. It's a 10-year lease and, you know, will be much more security for us as a gallery and representative.
Okay, and are you staying locally?
We're still in Dublin too. We're still at Trinity, opposite Trinity College, but on the other side. So we're going to Dalira Street.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
All right.
And it's the corner unit, the old Irish Times building.
Oh,
which is lovely.
Yes, of course. Beautiful building.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Gorgeous.
And long vacation.
Yes.
Okay, so that's good news for people who are clients of yours
yes.
and hop into the gallery. They don't have to too much further
yeah.
to get to you. Now, tell us about the art sale. So you're not taking everything with you in one go. You're getting
We're taking a few
selling
bits,
off.
Yeah. So we put it out. We've never done a sale in all 22 years of owning the art gallery. But we just put it out there with the artists and we said, do you want to do a little discount sale? And so they can prepare for new works for a fresh start and a new space. And a lot of them came back and have said yes to like 10%, 20%, 30%. And I have collected a lot of work over the years. So I'm kind of trying to do a bit clear out as well. So there's a lot of pieces and there's a lot of deals in the gallery for like some are 50% off as well. So,
okay, that's
yeah.
great. Value,
it's worth popping in till we close
because
of right to the end.
Your misfortune or good fortune,
yeah.
then other people clean up.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, tell me a little bit about some artists that are included. Now, I know that Kieran Guckian, who who made a landscape artist of the year at the very popular Sky Arts show. Folks, if you haven't seen it, they portrait artist of the year, landscape artist of the year, and our Kieran made the final of that. Mm-hmm. So he has a piece in
he
this.
He has loads of lovely little pieces that are reduced at, I think it's 15% on his. Now, the new piece that was featured on that programme is going to be launched in the new gallery space. And that's going to be hanging on the gallery wall for the big launch.
Oh, fantastic.
So, yeah, we won't be discounting that just yet.
Well, you might need to, of course.
No, I don't think so, because it's fabulous.
It'll fly.
Yeah.
It is fabulous.
But have a look
beautiful.
On the website, because all his little ones that we had at Christmas are all reduced.
Are you finding the art world in Ireland still vibrant?
It's brilliant, yeah. And because I used to do 6 shows in London every year, so I was back and forth taking part in different international art fairs, and I don't have to do that anymore. The market here is so good, and we're still doing obviously the try before you buy with everything. So yeah, no, Ireland is great for art at the moment, and the UK market isn't so what I'm hearing. So yeah, we're staying focused on our own market.
Yeah, no tariffs for you.
No, we're safe away from the tariffs, thank God.
And of course, Denise, the tie before you buy, we've spoken about
yes.
it before. People
yeah.
can kind of effectively hang up one of an artwork, try it in their home, see where it fits, and then make a decision on that, which is a great facility. Do you
it's
find
brilliant.
Many people take it up?
Lots, yeah. So that's, I'm not even in the gallery anymore. I'm going out in the van every day, going to people's houses, and it's really getting to know your clients as well. So
yeah.
Once I see their house, I can go, oh yeah, that would suit really well. So I'm WhatsApping them pictures of paintings when they come in. This might look good in your hall. So,
Okay. So it's not like they've chosen one piece and you're going out to say put it on that wall instead of that wall. It's
Work. You see, you know, they come into the gallery, they have a look, and then I go out to their house with a few pieces. And sometimes it doesn't work. It's a journey with the customer, and then I go out the following week with other pieces, and eventually we get there. But yeah, it's nice though. It's a
nice collaboration.
It's a nice part of my job. Yeah, I love
it. And it's nice to be able to live with a piece for a little while, because you don't know, like, you're going to be looking at it every day, and it has to work for you.
Exactly. And it's hard for couples to agree on a painting.
Oh, who
I mean, we get wedding lists in the gallery, and they come in and they're arguing about it.
Oh my God. Listen, that's going to be lifelong.
Yes.
Folks, if you're getting married, don't put art near your wedding list.
You have to buy one each. That's the deal. Yeah.
I've a secret plan there. I put up art and wait to see how long it takes to be noticed.
Yes, it's very clever. Lots of women do that.
Possibly shouldn't have said that live on air. Right. Okay. What is your own favourite piece in the sale?
I have to say my favourite at the moment would be the Lucy Doyles, and she's allowing 20% on certain pieces, so check out the website. So some artists are allowing 30% on certain works as well. So yeah, it's worth checking out the website. But everybody's taking part in the sale, so you're bound to get something. And we are bringing all these artists to the new gallery. We're still promoting them, so they are still an investment.
Brilliant. Now, of course, some people can get a little bit nervous at the thoughts of entering an art gallery, whether it's your current premises or maybe the brand new present. Might be curiosity, but they might think, oh, I'm a bit intimidated and everything is so expensive, and what if I don't like anything? What would you say to those people?
We're very different. We welcome in people off the street. And one thing with the building we've been in and the gallery space, you did have to ring a doorbell to enter, and that does put people off because it is quite intimidating. So with the new building we're moving to, it's an open door policy. It's just us in the building. So we will have the doors open. We will welcome everyone. There's something for everyone, every price range. I always remember years ago on my first gallery on Francis Street, and a man used to come in every week just for his own soul. He just used to love art, and he said, I'll never be able to afford anything. But we used to talk to him, and, you know, then one day he won the lotto.
So, really?
Yeah, and he became a very good buyer. So, you know, we're invested
what
in all different
story.
Customers.
That's your dream client right there.
So you never
he could
know.
Have bought the gallery.
So you come in, we welcome everyone.
Right. Now, I hope you're not linking the two. Go into the doorway gallery and you might win the lotto. Right.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, you have to rub a certain sculpture.
But if you do, that would be a good place to start. All right. Well, listen, it's always a pleasure to have you on. That's Denise Donnelly from the Doorway Gallery. And of course, people can find you on Instagram.
Everywhere. We're all over social media, and obviously the website, thedoorwaygallery.com.
Fantastic.
Thank you. All right.
Well, listen, thanks for joining us. And look, it's worth hopping on, having a look at some of the artists. They're absolutely beautiful. There's such a wide range of subjects and all that there's something for everyone. All right. Thanks a million,
Thank
Denise.
Thank you.
Now, almost all of us have one, I'd guess. It's called a pouf, a footstool, or an ottoman. But what is the difference, and how do we find out? Well, joining me now to answer this very tricky question is show regular Denise O'Connor from Optimised Design. Denise, you're very welcome on the show. It is a bit perplexing because they're all kind of things that sit on the floor and you stick your feet on. Is there a difference between the three of them? What is it? Let's start with, I don't know, the ottoman.
The ottoman, yeah. Well, there definitely is a difference. And I suppose there's sort of words that people use interchangeably to mean one version or the other, but there are actually differences between the three. So the ottoman is something that I suppose if you visualise maybe a more period home, it would be more traditional. It might be large, sort of buttoned footstool type piece of furniture with maybe wooden legs, often upholstered in quite a luxurious fabric, could double as a coffee table, that sort of thing. Or the other use for an ottoman would be at the end of a bed. So if you have a very large bedroom, you could maybe have an ottoman at the end of your bed. And often these pieces of furniture would have lift up seats for extra storage, that kind of thing. So they sort of multi-purpose. They tend to be larger, I suppose, than say the footstool or the pouf.
And the Ottoman, does that name come from like the Ottoman Empire?
I believe it does. Okay. Yeah, I believe that's where it originated from. So probably dates back, you know, very far into history. So these things have been around for a very long time.
Okay, so the feature of that is the storage. It's a little bit larger.
Yeah.
And is it probably the oldest of the models?
I would say so, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Now, the pouf.
The pouf. So for me, the pouf conjures up, I mean, even the word sounds soft, you know,
yeah.
Sort of. So, it takes me back to my childhood. I'm showing my age now, but say the 1970s, you can visualize these. Often they were circular. They were sort of used as a footstool or an extra little seat. Very popular now, and they come in all shapes and sizes. A lot of circular ones that often you see them, they look like giant knitted balls, that sort of thing. They're great for kids' rooms. So they're sort of a soft addition. They're almost like an accessory as well as an extra little seat, or, you know, they wouldn't have storage in them, for example. Mm. They literally are a little accessory, a way to add a pop of colour or just have an extra seat in the room.
Okay, that's the pouf,
yeah.
And very 1970s vibes about that,
yes,
I will say. And then finally, the footstool, which you kind of think, okay, that probably encompasses the whole genre of this item of furniture. But is that a very specific thing?
It is. So, I mean, of course, the ottoman and the pouf can be used as footstools. But I suppose the footstool in its own right is a specific thing designed to pop your feet up when you're sitting on a chair. So often you would get lovely, say a recliner will often come with a separate footstool. So they look quite different. They might just be like almost a floating rest for your seat on a very slim leg. There's very contemporary versions now for amazing, you know, reclining chairs, that sort of thing. Or it can look like a tiny version of an ottoman. So, you know, just quite a nice upholstered top with little wooden legs, but they tend to be much smaller. So they are just for one person's feet.
They're like a dedicated thing for per chair.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly,
yeah. And of course you have, now again, going back to the kind of the 80s, the Friends vibe where Chandler and Joey had this apartment and they'd pull up the sides and the footstool would come sliding out of the sofa while they watched Baywatch or whatever they were watching. So those footstools can be integrated then into some chairs.
Yeah, and actually like with sofas, a footstool option is a great option where if let's say you have your heart set on an L-shaped sofa, but maybe you don't have the space to commit to that kind of large fixed piece of furniture in your room, go with a footstool that matches the sofa in matching fabric, and that gives you the option. So you can use it when you're reclining. Mm. It can go at either end of the sofa, and then it can be kind of pulled to the side, tucked away when you're not using it.
Okay, now for all three, the ottoman, the footstool and the pouf, is it always acceptable to put your feet on them?
Unless your feet are very, very dirty shoes or something, I would say yes. I would think so. I would think so, yeah.
Because I'm conscious that some people use that piece of furniture, whatever you call it,
yes,
as maybe like a bit like a table substitute.
Yes, it can be used as a coffee table, and especially the ottoman, which can come very large. I mean, you can get really, really oversized ottomans. And then what people tend to do is to upholster them in very plush or expensive fabrics, in which case maybe, yes, the homeowner would think it's not quite acceptable to pop your feet up on it.
Okay. And of course, you can accessorize that. There's a big trend now for putting trays with bits, you know, or like candles or floating doofers or coffee table books on the ottoman.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful way to sort of accessorize. You can add, again, a pop of colour. There's amazing companies as well that sell these beautifully ornate feet. So even if you did pick up something in a charity shop or, an antique store, you could have great fun just reupholstering it and then changing the legs and really create something quite striking, you know, without the striking price tag.
Yeah. Is there an optimum height for it?
That's a good question. They come in different heights. I would suppose maybe 450 millimetres from the ground. That's like seat level. So nothing higher than that, because then your legs are going to be up high.
Mm.
So no higher than the seat.
Mm. And in terms of fabric then, because we have to be conscious if we are going to be kind of lounging on it with or without shoes in our feet, it has to be quite durable. What is your... I have two of them. at home.
Yeah.
Although I'm still not sure which, if they are a footstool, a pouf, or an ottoman. I'm going to go with footstool because that's my favourite term. I've one that is a kind of a buttoned velvet.
Lovely. Yeah.
And then the other one, though, is a hardier. It's like leather. Now, it's battered and it's old and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the one I definitely wouldn't mind about putting my feet up on. So what fabrics work with it?
I would go with anything that's suitable for upholstery. So if you look at the back of fabrics, it'll tell you whether it can be used for curtains, suitable for upholstery. And then all fabrics have what they call a rub test. So that's basically the way of determining how durable these fabrics are. So the higher the rub test, the more durable and indestructible the fabric's going to be. So always worth checking that. And then if you're unsure, you're not too sure what these things mean, ask the people in the store to help you out.
Now, you were mentioning there, like, the upholstery of it would often be in the same colour as your sofa arrangement because they come with it and it's so like that. But is there the opportunity for a colour pop or a design change
with
this furniture?
Yeah, so matching the sofa, I would suggest doing if you're trying to create that L-shaped sofa look in the space. But then if you're going for, in particular, the ottomans, I mean, go mad. You know, you can really sort of do anything from stripes to vibrant patterns to a real pop of, you know, amazing velvet colour. Maybe, as I say, change the legs, even introduce colour there. So, yeah, anything goes.
I've seen some of them, especially the kind of the antique types, where it's made out of nearly like a low luggage chest.
Yes.
And then an upholstered kind of cushion on top.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably it would be a great upcycling opportunity.
Absolutely. And, you know, really, if you're thinking about the purpose, as long as it's going to be soft, it's going to allow you to either use it as the coffee table or pop your feet up. You can be as creative as you like, you know, and repurpose things you might have lying around. Have fun with it.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's a nice, simple piece to get away with because it's usually rectangular. It's very straightforward and it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things.
No, exactly. And you can always change it up, you know, so you could always reupholster, change the colour, whatever you need to do. So you can. It's definitely an opportunity to have fun.
And finally, then the real key question, the controversy, is it ever okay to sit on it?
Oh, yeah. Well, these things often double as seats. And it's, again, in small spaces, these types of furniture items are invaluable because they're neat. They can be moved around. They can go with you, particularly people say renting in smaller apartments, that sort of thing. So they're a brilliant investment, really, because they multi-purpose. And that's so important.
All right. So that's the footstool, the pouf and the ottoman. What's your preferred term, Denise?
I like the footstool as well.
Okay.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Comforts of all righty. Well, listen, thanks for bringing us all that and delving into where we put our feet in the house. Denise O'Connor from Optimize Design on all of that. And I'm afraid that's it. That's all we have time for on this week's episode. I hope you have enjoyed the various little bits that we had and maybe got a tiny bit of inspiration for any projects you might be doing around the place. If you'd like to get in touch with us during the week, it's thehomeshow@newstalk.com. And you'll find me over on Instagram at SineadRyan100. Always happy to interact with people there. Don't forget to check out any episodes you've missed. They're all up online on our podcast, The Home Show. And you can go and find that. Thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McClune was on sound. And we will see you all again next week. Hopefully it'll still officially be summer. And we'll chat to you then.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.